On writing, you have in the background Gary Bartz from the soundtrack I've Known Rivers by Langston Hughes, and I am Dr. Brenda Green, Executive Director of the Center for Black Literature and Director of the National Black Writers Conference at Megar Evers College. We are coming to you from the studio of Megar Evers College over the airways of WNYE 91.5 FM. Writers on Writing comes to you every Sunday and gives you, our listening audience, an opportunity to hear writers from the African diaspora talk about their work, their craft, and their lives. And I am very pleased to have on the telephone with me this evening an award-winning writer, Nafisa Thompson Spiers. Or is it Spiers or Spiers?
It's Spiers.
Spiers. Thank you so much for agreeing to have this interview. And Nafisa, if you don't mind if I call you Nafisa, is is the author of the short story collection Heads of the Colored People, which just won the award from PEN America, the Beyond Margins Award. She is also the author of, or her work, I should say, has appeared in the Paris Review Daily, Dissent, BuzzFeed, Banned, The White Review, the Los Angeles Review of Books Quarterly Journal, Story Quarterly, Lunch Ticket, East Bay Review. Her short story, Heads of the Colored People, which is the title of her collection of short stories, won Story Quarterly's 2016 Fiction Award. And I just want to say something. I had an opportunity to meet Nafisa at the PEN Literary Awards ceremony. And I'd like to share with you what the judges of the award said. Nafisa Thompson Spiers, Heads of the Colored People, is an original and thrilling debut. The short story collection deftly explores race as both foundational and ancillary in the lives of bickering school moms and melancholic teenagers, weaving together stories of Black upper middle class lives and contemporary teenagers, a book that's smart, funny, sly, charming, and devastating. But both of the moment and utterly timeless, these stories and the heads, in quotes, they inhabit, do the necessary and thrilling work of the best literature. They expand the understanding of what it means to be a human and alive in this moment. And it speaks to the fact that your stories really touch on so many themes, and they are witty. So I'm going to ask you, start by asking you to share with the listening audience the background for selecting the title of the short story, Heads of the Colored People, and then the subsequent title of the book, Heads of the Colored People. Tell us about the Heads of the Colored People and the story behind that title.
The title comes from a series of literary sketches by scholar and scientist James McKeon Smith, who was also an abolitionist. And he was writing in the 19th century about what it would look like for Black people to have the full rights of citizenship legally, and he was publishing these short literary sketches, often funny, sometimes satirical, ironic, in all kinds of newspapers, including Frederick Douglass's newspapers, along with a lot of his contemporaneous writers like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper. And these people were all kind of theorizing what it would mean for Black people to have the full rights of citizenship. And my husband researches James McKeon Smith and was always talking about how little had changed. He would come downstairs all the time with a quote from James McKeon Smith that seemed perfectly relevant. It could have been described in 2017 or 2018. And so I initially had the idea that I would update James McKeon Smith's original sketches, but I ended up finding that so little had changed that I kind of stole the title instead and used it for the theme of heads more broadly. So heads is in leadership, heads is in psychology. There's a literal head injury in one of the stories. and heads is in phrenology, kind of nodding back to that racist scientific practice.
Right. So as you said, these themes are timeless. These themes can go back to the 19th century. You raise many themes that relate to race, the Black body, identity, mental illness, dysfunctional families, grief. And these, as I said, they're dark themes, but at points you add humor, you add sarcasm. I was reminded of Ishmael Reed. You've obviously are a scholar yourself. You've done a lot of reading. You bring in a lot of names. In fact, as I was reading it, I sometimes went back to make sure that I was understanding the reference point you were making. So my question is, how do you develop the ideas for your stories? What is the process that you use to develop the ideas for your stories and for these?
It varies a lot. Sometimes I'm kind of haunted by a line. So with my titular story, Heads of the Colored People, Four Fancy Sketches, Two Chalk Outlines, and No Apology, which has a very long title.
I'm going to ask you to speak a little bit more slowly because sometimes it's a little, and it might be the cell phone. So just speak a little bit more slowly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My process varies. So for the title story, which is called Heads of the Colored People, Four Fancy Sketches, Two Chalk Outlines, and No Apology, I was kind of haunted by a particular line. And the line that kept coming back to me was, Riley wore blue contacts and bleached his hair blonde, and he was black. And I kind of just followed that line through a series of free writes, trying to figure out who this Riley character was and why he wouldn't leave me alone. And that turned into a story where I was in the process of discovering Riley, also discovering the plot. And that's often the process. I get a line. That's sort of the process for the story Suicide Watch as well. I had this idea of a girl who was kind of obsessed with social media and was thinking about committing suicide and announcing it online. But for some of the other stories, the concept comes to me first. It's like, I want to write about this particular thing, and I follow that path, and from there figure out who the characters are that would fit into that theme.
So you, as I said, you're coming up with themes and subjects that can be very disturbing. Is this related to what you're reading, or just what you're seeing in the world, or what is just impacting you personally?
I think it's very much what's happening in the world. I mean, both the title story, which is the first one in the collection, and the last story deal with police brutality in two very different ways. So in the first story, Riley is on his way to a comic book convention that's sort of like Comic-Con, and he gets gunned down, and so does the man he's interacting with. In the last story, a funeral singer in Chicago is exhausted from seeing so much black death, and she considers drowning her own baby. But we find out that her brother was killed a few years earlier in an interaction with the police. So both of those stories come from my understanding of real life events and the very pressing issue of police brutality and sort of state-sanctioned violence against black people. And I got the idea for the Chicago funeral singer in particular. There was an article that appeared in one of my news feeds at some point about a young, like teenage funeral singer in some city. And I didn't read the article, but I took the idea of a funeral singer and turned that into a character. And then in other cases, there are things that I feel are worth satirizing. So the story I mentioned, Suicide Watch, deals with sort of the hyper-attention that some people can get addicted to on social media and over-announcing everything. And other stories are somewhat autobiographical. I would say the three Fatima stories are the most like my own life.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, you know, in a sense of, Belle, it starts with Belle Lettres, and I was laughing as I was reading it because I know people like that. So I was going to ask you whether that was autobiographical or yes. You want to talk about that a little?
That story came from a really great writing prompt that my mom didn't realize she was providing for me. So she sent me this box of a bunch of junk from my childhood about 6 or 7 years ago. and she called it a care packet, but there were no cookies or anything nice in it. It was just random papers and things, a couple of newspaper articles that I'd been in. And one of the things that was in there was a letter from my childhood bully's mother talking about what a terrible child I was and how wonderful her own daughter was. And it made me remember that my mom was in a feud with this woman my entire, really my elementary through middle school life, but third grade in particular was when it was really heated. And we were the only two black girls in our class in third grade. We went to this very white private school. And every now and then there'd be another black girl in our grade, and then that person would leave the school. But in third grade, we were the only two black girls. And our mothers really didn't get along, and neither did we. And so I took that letter as kind of the inciting incident for a story and tried to reimagine what it would look like for these two women to be fighting in that very particular space.
Right. I thought about all of the moms. And you focus on, of course, many middle-class families. And I say the children of the those who grew up in the 60s, you end up being that kind of that next generation. And in many ways, the parents were much more political, but the children are not that way. You're reflecting what the millennial and aspects of the hip-hop generation represent in your stories. And I thought that
Sorry, go on.
No, I was saying, and what are your thoughts on that? Would you characterize that as true?
Yeah, I think I'm just past chronologically what people would say the post-soul writers, but the writers who are concerned with what you were just talking about, the people who are sort of right growing up, the next generation after people who would have been actively involved in the civil rights movement, and who would have grown up at the peak of hip-hop culture, and many of them also kind of on the cusp of being millennials. And I wanted to explore what Black life was like for them when a lot of people claim that we are also post-racial, which is obviously not true. That was kind of the initial organizing principle for the collection, to create a series of stories that made fun of the idea of post-racialism and what it would mean to be colorblind, when race is such an important part of all of our lives, and especially a Black life. But I also wanted to set it among middle-class Black people in particular, because I didn't feel like I'd seen enough of those stories growing up, or even today. So again, a lot of the post-soul writers do write about middle-class Black people. But I wanted to write about Black nerds and Black people who were the only one or one of the only one, and who didn't feel like they fit very well with the stereotypes about Black culture, and obviously couldn't fit into white culture either because they're not white.
Well, I think you've done a wonderful job of that. One of the things that, I don't know if you remember, that Sandra Cisnero said that what people should be writing about is what they don't want to forget or what they're afraid to talk about. And mm-hmm. I think that ends up being reflected in your stories. I mean, that story about Whisper is a screen that was really very, very moving. And a Whisper to a Scream, that was very moving to me. And
thanks.
And Wash and Clean the Bones. You know, it's this Todd. What was the impetus behind this Todd?
This Todd is probably the most absurd story in the collection, I would say. And I was really interested in the idea of a Black woman not being fetishized, because we've seen a lot of that historically, not just in literature, but in real life, Black women who are treated as parts and not as a whole person, and whose parts, like their butts, for thinking about the Venus Hottentot, Sarji Bartman, or other Black women who have been fetishized for a very specific part of their body or part of Black culture. I wanted the Black woman to be in the opposite position as the one doing the fetishizing. And I wanted to think about what it would mean for her to do it to Black men. Mm. So in that story, this Todd, the character Kim, is kind of obsessively pursuing Black men who are living with leg amputations, because she gets some kind of pleasure out of being in control over these men who are living with disabilities. And it gets very dark in what she does at the end of that story.
Yes, it does. So going back to you, the writer, as I said earlier, you reference a lot of books and writers. You reference performance artists. Who are the people who influenced you? Who influenced you as a writer? And who are the people who you're reading?
Well, I love that you started out by saying my collection reminded you of Ishmael Reed, because I would say he's one of my top influences and one of my favorite writers ever. I love that Ishmael Reed kind of played with form in so many ways that feel refreshing and new, sometimes a little confusing, and that his work has so much intertextuality in it, and kind of, for me, is the best work that came from the sort of postmodernist movement. I also like George Schuyler, who came before Ishmael Reed and was doing similar work. His book, Black No More, is one of my favorite novels ever. And then all those post-soul writers I was referencing, people like Matt Johnson and Colson Whitehead and Paul Beatty, who are doing similar kinds of things with form and playfulness and writing about Black middle-class characters in a lot of cases. And then who I'm reading now, I'm reading a lot of galleys. People are sending me a lot of unpublished books at the moment, which is nice. The one that I just finished is by a writer named Kylie Reed, a young Black writer who's finishing her MFA at Iowa. But I've also been reading other stuff that has nothing to do with Blackness. Caitlin Moran's book, How to Build a Girl, was probably one of the favorite things I've read in the past couple of months.
Okay. Would you like to share an excerpt from your collection with us?
Sure.
Okay.
I think I will read from Belle Lettre, since we talked about that story.